there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motika, your host for an hour of medical news, healthcare, science in the news, debate, dialogue, discussions, and answers to your emails and your phone calls right here on Ask Dr. Dawn. Before I go any further, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It is not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. We have an early bird caller who is waiting on the line, calling from Plattsburgh, New York. Hello, Bonnie from Plattsburgh. How are you?
Dawn, yes, I am calling from Plattsburgh.
How can I help you today?
Well, about 15 years ago, I lost my sense of smell, and I had RK surgery done for my eyes, and they gave me some very strong drops after the surgery to stop the eyeball from changing shape, and I suspect that that was probably the culprit.
Is the timing right? Like you used the drops, and then the next week you noticed you couldn't smell?
Well, you know, I didn't even realize that I couldn't smell until, anyway, it was a situation where I was in a gymnasium with a bunch of kids, and the farmer was spreading manure in the field, and, you know, one of the kids were all complaining about the smell, and I'm going, what smell? Mm-hmm. And that's when I realized that I didn't have a sense of smell. So it was about a month after, I'm going to say.
Okay, so it's possible there could be a connection, although most people who lose their sense of smell notice it when they eat, because they lose their appetite.
Right. You know, I don't think mine was gone. It was gone enough so that when I went to an ear, nose, and throat specialist and they gave me the scratch and sniff test, yes, I failed it miserably. Everything smelled like gasoline to me. I didn't recognize anything.
Okay.
So then about 5 years ago, we've been retired for a while. We went to Florida, and we were there for about a month. And during that month, I regained my sense of smell and was able to smell everything.
Okay, that's very interesting.
Then I came home, and then I was not able to smell again. And then every once in a great while, like it'll be a fleeting thing, maybe for 10 minutes or so, I'll be able to smell and taste, and you know, everything kind of comes back. So I had a CT scan of my sinuses. They're fine. They gave me prednisone and said, you know, if this doesn't work, nothing will, and sent me away. Mm-hmm. So the prednisone did not help, but then still, since then, I've had glimpses of when I can smell again. So someone suggested maybe it was a moisture problem. So I bought a facial mister, and I used that. And the day after I used it, I felt like this gigantic plug kind of release, and you know, and I ended up swallowing it. But I really think that there was something blocking it, because since then, it happened 2 days in a row, and it hasn't happened since. Things have improved slightly. I was using the neti pot before, but sometimes the neti pot, the saline would just come right back out the same nostril. Mm-hmm. But now it goes all the way through. I've used it twice a day, and I guess I'm calling to see if you might have any other suggestions of things that I can try.
Well, the first thing I would do is probably test you for allergies, and not just IgE, but IgG. And
well, I've done allergy testing. I
know,
about
and you've been tested for IgE because you went to an allergist.
2 years, and I said supposedly was cured after 2 years.
Okay, so basically you went to a standard conventional allergist, you got IgE testing, you were found to be positive, and treated with desensitization therapy, and the nasal symptoms did not abate.
Right.
Right, okay. So, like I said, IgG is possibly the culprit. There's a couple of things that are different about Florida and New York, okay? A lot of the plants are different. Moisture content in the air is different. So environmental allergens are a possibility. But like you said, you've done the IgE thing, and they've chased that, and they've also chased it with prednisone. IgG is a little trickier, and that's the one that will react with food. And the other thing that's different possibly when you went to Florida was your diet. I'm just hypothesizing. I'm not making a diagnosis here because that's impossible. But a place that hasn't been looked at is dietary allergies or sensitivities. And I'll go through just a brief concept of what's going on here. The hypothetical mechanism is that one eats something, a little bit of that protein on the food is recognized by the immune system. The immune system makes antibodies against it. Then the next time you consume the food, particularly if you consume it regularly, you form what are called an antigen-haptan complex, and this floats around in your bloodstream and deposits in capillary beds where it sets up inflammation. Theoretically, and again, remember, we're hypothesizing here, that could induce enough nasal congestion to prevent the smell from getting up to the olfactory bulb, which is the sensors there at the very top of your nose. So your thing that you said about the neti pot, sometimes the fluid comes right back out and doesn't seem to pass, would fit with swelling of the turbinates lower down, kind of acting like one of those doors on the old Star Trek where the doors close from the sides automatically.
Mm-hmm.
So literally the door closes and the air can't rise to where the sensors are. And then at some point, miraculously, it clears out intermittently and you get some air up there and you can smell, and then it shuts back down again and you don't have the circulation to the olfactory bulb. So what I find really interesting about your case is that you don't have a complete loss of your sense of smell that is intermittently lost.
Oh, no, it's lost most of the time. But
yes, it comes back at all means that the nerves aren't dead, and that's my
point.
Oh,
right, that's what was exciting to me,
That's my point, yes. And that is exciting, because sometimes people will kill those little nerves, mm-hmm. and they can be killed with chemicals. It's, you know, could have been as a reaction to an eye drop that got into the nose. That's all plausible. But if it killed them, they'd be dead, and they mm-hmm. wouldn't be coming back online and then going back offline. So there's something else at work here. And you've explored some traditional avenues and had some improvement with the steam, which is intriguing. So I do think it might be worth getting tested for food and spice sensitivities. And you can go ahead and email me and I'll send you some links about how to get that testing. I don't do a lot of direct advice on the air for obvious reasons. This is not a show where I can make diagnoses, but I will go ahead and put you in the direction of where you can get this testing done.
Okay, and the other two things are that my nose runs a lot.
That would fit with my hypothesis.
My ears itch.
Yeah, that would all fit with this antibody to food antigen concept that I'm talking about. Those are all symptoms of that. Other symptoms, there can be some GI upset or not. There can be some joint pain or not. And there can be these skin itching or rashes, particularly around the butt, but also in random other places on your body, or not. So just throwing those things out there, it would be very interesting for you to pursue this kind of testing.
Okay, so IgG testing.
Yes.
Okay, and I will email you and you'll point me in the right direction.
That's right. You just go to the Ask Dr. Don website
and
identify yourself as the caller from New York from this date, and then I'll go ahead and send it back to you.
Okay, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
All right, bye.
Bye-bye. An email that I wanted to get to, this is from Peter in Vero Beach, Florida, writes about sunscreen. To quote Peter, "I've often wondered if the body has systems to protect itself from the sun, such as melanin production." Well, yes, Peter, that's it. The level of protection increases with exposure to the sun. So blocking exposure to the sun with sunscreen thus lowers the level of protective state of the skin. Exactly the problem. This seems to me that this would place regular sunscreen users at increased vulnerability to sun damage when the occasional sun exposure occurs without sunscreen. So this is absolutely true. Now the trick, and we talked about this quite extensively last week, so I won't belabor the issue, the trick is finding a sunscreen that doesn't itself have a lot of theoretical risks attached because of generating free radicals or other chemical properties which might even make it sun sensitizing, like containing retinoic acid. So go to the link on the Ask Dr. Don website, hit the resources button, and you'll find a link to a cosmetic database. This is sponsored by Environmental Working Group. It has an excellent section on sunscreen, but it also contains information about just about every cosmetic you can think of. And surprisingly enough, cosmetics are not nearly as well regulated as drugs. This includes cosmetics we put on our lips or put in our eyes. It's a little bit crazy, but I think that we need to take a step back, ladies, particularly because we're the primary users of most cosmetics, and make sure that what we're putting on and in our body is in fact safe for us, or at least doesn't contain large quantities of stuff we know isn't safe. So I'm going to be hitting that database quite regularly, and in fact, I programmed it into my little BlackBerry for exactly that purpose. There is another link on my website for the Safe Cosmetics Act, which is looking at making sure that materials are, in fact, tested by standard criteria before they're released to the public. And the link to that, so that you can support this bill to your representative, is right there on the website. We try to make it easy for you. Please write a letter. It's amazing what a letter signed by you will do it counts for 100 phone calls and 1,000 emails. So please write a letter, spend the money for a stamp. Let me give you this one. This is from Mark in San Jose. We're going to be talking about some healthcare things that came up in the news recently. So this is a good starter. Mark had outpatient surgery for a finger fracture a while back. He was in the hospital for 6 hours, and then he got the bill. And the bill was a total of $27,000 within the bill that was just classified as hospital incidentals, not itemized. And according to the agreed upon pricing with his insurance company is going to pay $2,400. That's right, an entire order of magnitude different. And Mark's portion of that is $276. So Mark's paying his copay around 10%. The actual payment to the hospital is about, come to think of it, 10% of the bill. Mark goes on with a very clever analogy. He says, imagine going into Starbucks and ordering a coffee and then being told it would be $125. Then the next person in line says, my negotiated price with you is $2.40, and the barista complies. And then the next person says they are on government-assisted coffee service and they will only pay $1.80. Why does medical care have this strange pricing structure? And indeed, my producer sent a query to Mark, and Mark sent me his bill, and it really is very interesting. We won't, of course, name the hospitals, but the hospital incidentals include, well, that's all it says. Outpatient anesthesia is priced. Hospital incidentals work out to, well, minus the anesthesia, about $25,000. And the total patient responsibility worked out to about $300. So I can confirm this bizarre billing structure. Part of it is driven by the way the contracts are written, Mark. And the contracts with the health insurance companies basically are written to force a discount against the standard pricing. What that does is cause the hospitals and the medical offices too, for that matter, to jack up their standard pricing so that the percentage of their standard pricing is something that they can live with. You can bet that the hospital's cost, actual absolute cost for doing the work, is somewhere around what they got paid, because if it was too much below that, they would jack up the prices at the next contract negotiation. And the insurance companies would let them because the companies have to keep their vendors in business. They take the hospitals out of business, that blows their business, because then there's one or two hospitals still around and they have major market leverage. In terms of your situation, the contracts also specify that the hospital is not allowed to charge less to someone without insurance, because if people without insurance could get these vastly lower prices, well, then they would pay for insurance. So really, when you buy health insurance, you're buying two things. You're buying protection against a catastrophic event, and you're buying this discount, a leveraged discount. And if you stopped paying for your insurance, you would lose this leverage discount and the hospital would be contractually obligated to charge you 10 times their actual operating cost. Is the word crazy, insane, mixed up system occurring to you? Well, it certainly has occurred to me in the past. And in a related story, talking about this crazy mixed up system, you may recall a couple of weeks ago we talked about one of the provisions in the Healthcare Insurance Reform Act that was going to go into effect in September of this year, and that was that children could no longer be denied health insurance coverage for pre-existing conditions. Sounds like a good idea. Well, guess what? Multiple insurance companies, and this is in Florida, we've got Blue Cross Blue Shield Aetna and the subsidiary of United Healthcare, have all announced that they're going to stop issuing individual policies for children, because after all, the only people who would buy individual policies for their children would be people with sick children, children either sick or likely to become sick. And therefore, we'll just stop writing those policies because these people would be unfairly taking advantage of the insurance companies by purchasing a policy for their child with leukemia. In fact, quoting, Randy Kramer, vice president of Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Florida, we believe that the majority of people who would buy this policy were going to use it immediately, probably for high-cost claims. Guaranteed issue means you could technically buy it on the way to the hospital, and this would obviously be an abuse. Now, what the insurance company is proposing to the Obama administration to get around this adverse selection issue is an open enrollment. So parents could only get guaranteed coverage during a designated month each year, or if the family went through a major change, such as a divorce or a parent losing their job. This is the Sally Back from the insurance company. If you don't change the law to create this open enrollment 1 month out of the year where people can sign up, and if you don't sign up then, oh, too bad, so sad, you're on the public rolls for a year, we will simply stop writing insurance for individual policies for children. Nya, 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 nya. We can still do that. Take a deep breath. I've got another one for you. UnitedHealthcare, and this is Dr. Sam Ho, is talking about UnitedHealthcare's proposal to the Obama administration that we create these plans that are reduced premiums, but that require participants to use a very narrow selection of doctors or hospitals. Now, what do you want to bet that these doctors and hospitals are going to be chosen on the basis of quality of outcome? And what do you want to bet the definition of quality is going to be shortest length of hospital stay and the most number of patients you can cram through the office in a 24-hour period? Well, I'm going to bet that the quality measures are going to be quality of the bank account of the stockholders or of these vastly overpaid chief executives of these quote-unquote nonprofit plans. Quoting a small business owner, Peter Skoda, "What this does is eliminate the Gucci doctors." In other words, if the doctors are not on this list of very highly cost-effective physicians, they're Gucci doctors. Sounds to me a lot like that old thing about latte liberals. And speaking as a card-carrying latte liberal, I would say that that's going to play real well on Fox. And good luck to you, America. You get the health plan that you deserve from the politicians that you deserve. So get out there, vote, march, write, or these people are going to take us to the cleaners yet again. And we need healthcare reform, folks. Let's go to Susan in Monterey. Hello, Susan, and welcome to the program.
Thank you for having my call. I wanted to ask you if you could help me with the information on PAD, peripheral artery disease.
Sure, I can. What are your questions?
I'm told that there's some new treatments that can regenerate the nerves. I heard something about it on a radio show, and I unfortunately wasn't able to write down the address, but I just wondered if you had any information on that.
Well, what you're saying is a little confusing to me because peripheral artery disease is not a neurologic disease. It's not a disease of the nerves. So are you sure that it wasn't peripheral neuropathy that you were listening to on the radio? I think that you might be confused
the
two.
You may be right, but I think at the beginning they said it was peripheral artery. I get the numbness in my toes and, you know, my feet. I can still, manipulate my toes and walk and everything, but there's a numbness and a deadish feeling.
Okay, so here's how we can work on this. The next time you go to the doctor, ask the doctor to check an ankle brachial index. This is a really easy test. Any doctor's office can do it. And basically what they're doing is they're measuring the blood pressure in your arm and then measuring the blood pressure in your foot. They put the cuff around your calf and blow it up and cut off the circulation, and then they see at what point it opens up. If the blood pressure in your arm is equal or higher than the blood pressure in your foot, then you do have peripheral artery disease, which is blocked pipes, blocked arteries, into the feet. And while that can cause numbness, typically it causes pain first. Now we're going to talk about what would cause numbness first, and that would be peripheral neuropathy. And peripheral neuropathy can be due to some vitamin deficiencies. It can be due to old age. There are a couple of drugs, particularly chemotherapy drugs, that can trigger it. And a lot of peripheral neuropathy is unidentified in terms of its cause, and it's very common. And it's a symmetric loss of sensation in the toes. We call it a stocking glove loss because it's as if you were pulling a sock up over your foot and gradually you lose the sensation. I am not aware of any new nerve regenerative treatments for peripheral neuropathy. I'll go ahead and search for that and see if I can come up with anything. And if I find anything, I'll bring it back next week. Are you a regular listener?
I am definitely, and I'm a very devoted fan.
Well, thank you.
And I thank you, Bert, for the information. So I will look forward to hearing that. Thank you for your program.
All right. Well, thank you very much. And I've got a homework assignment.
Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And let's go now to Will in Scotts Valley. Hello, Will, and welcome to the program.
Good morning, Dr. Dawn. My question concerns an article I read in Health News, June 22nd, 2010. It concerns a study at the University of Oxford of 12,000 patients where they were attempting to find out whether homocysteine levels has an effect on heart attack and stuff like that. They were given B12 and folic acid, and the study concluded that although there was some lowering of homocysteine in the study group, it did not have any effect, any positive effect on reduction in heart attack and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And this went over a very long period. Like,
how long?
Maybe 10 years.
Okay, well, I would say that 10 years would be probably about the minimum amount of time that you would need to identify this. So that's one comment I have. The second thing I would say is that it's impossible to prove a negative. So all you can do is support or not support the null hypothesis. This is a philosophical issue in statistics that's important to understand, is that you set up a study with the idea that there is no difference. And then you design the study so that if there turns out to be a difference in the group, then that's failure to support the concept that there's no difference. So maybe there is a difference, but it could be random. And the chance of it being random, we arbitrarily have decided that if the chance of being random is 1 out of 20 or less, then we're going to call that potentially meaningful. And we know that 1 out of 20 isn't that strict a criteria. And a lot of times we'll get a positive result, and then later on someone else will get a negative result. And then the questions get into, well, did they do exactly the same experiment and yada, yada. When you add to that the complexity of the linkages between genetics and diet and environmental variability, and you're dealing with wild type humans and not lab rats who share almost the same exact genome, then you run into so much variability that it gets even more difficult to know whether something is really meaningful. So what we know about B12 and folate and how they might affect heart disease is a significant amount of biochemistry. And then we've got epidemiologic stuff that supports the idea that if you eat a lot of B vitamins, that you are healthier and you have a lower homocysteine, unless, of course, you have a genetic mutation, which I'll come back to. And in that case, there's a linkage between the epidemiology of diet and the frequency of heart disease and stroke. But, of course, diets that are rich in B12 and folate are rich in a whole bunch of other things as well. And so is it the B12 and folate that we can measure, or is it the thousands or tens of thousands of compounds we can't measure that come along for the ride in the diet rich in B12 and folate that are doing you the good and showing up as a difference in heart disease rates? So because we have this everything has to look like a drug mentality, and because our method of scientific validation requires that we isolate all the variables, we're stuck with doing these studies where you take like B12 or just folate and you give a dose. And of course, what dose do you pick? And did you pick the right dose? Did you give too much? Did you give too little? Are all questions that you have to ask whenever somebody sets a study like this up. And then you get, you know, no results after 10 years. But let me give you an example of something. So I've just explained why I'm not going to allow any single study to really persuade me that vitamins don't work. But on the other hand, I don't generally advise using vitamins unless I've identified a mutation or I know based on other data that there's a problem with absorption after a certain age, et cetera, et cetera. But I don't really expect a mega vitamin study to show a variation unless the number of people is very large and the duration of treatment is very long. And even then, nowadays with our current technology, that's not how I would set up a study. If I was really interested in finding out about B12 and folate, I would take my potential experimental cohort and I would pick the people, the 1 out of 10 in the population who actually has the mutations that make it likely that they would benefit from B12 and folate supplementation. And then I would do my testing on that subgroup. And then I might be able to show something over 5 years with 5,000 people, which would be a feasible number of people to study and a feasible duration of time. It's a long latency disease, and I think you have to separate prevention of a disease versus treatment of an existing disease, because A lot of nutrient therapies may work really well for prevention of the disease in the first place, but once you have the disease, you may need drugs in order to show a benefit because the thing has already got momentum and is moving. So I know a very long-winded answer, but I hope that covered your issues as well as gave my listeners background on the issue.
Actually, one of the things that we're trying to find out whether lower homocysteine levels was a good indication.
Right. Yeah. And the problem with the homocysteine is, let me put it to you this way. Let's suppose that high homocysteine is a result of having this mutation in your body, and you're 40 years old. So by the time I've found this mutation that's causing high homocysteine that could be treated with mega and vitamin therapy, by the time I've identified that, you've already developed coronary artery disease that's clinically silent. So now I take away the thing that set you up to have the coronary artery disease, and your homocysteine levels drop, but you've already got the coronary artery disease. So that horse done left the barn, as I like to say to my patients. The cat is out of the bag, the horse done left the barn. You're not getting back anything now because you dropped the homocysteine level too late to do yourself any good. You might have to drop the homocysteine level in these people at 20 in order to show a benefit at 60. See what I'm saying?
Yes.
Might be too late. Okay.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye. So let's go to Anne in Santa Cruz.
Hello.
Hello, how are you?
I'm well, very well, thank you. I'm a 66-year-old person. I'm healthy and not overweight, and my cholesterol shot up, apparently having to do with genetics and a hormonal change.
Ah, so is this your estrogen levels changed?
Well, as soon as menopause hit, things started climbing.
Yep, I see that quite a lot, actually. Yeah, not every woman, but it's fairly common. Go ahead.
Well, I decided that was it, but that apparently was only part of the soup. There's a genetic component also. My doctor put me on simvastatin last June, and I found it to be very disagreeable. I was extremely fatigued.
So you stopped it?
I did.
Good.
And then she said, well, let's try diet. That didn't do a thing. It didn't move anything in 4 months. So she said, it's not your fault, it's genetic. And I do remember that was my dad's situation. We tried pravastatin. That worked better, but from October to May, I gradually found the fatigue issue again. Mm-hmm. Took longer, and finally in June, I called her and I said, I got to quit this. This is really changing my life.
All right, good decision.
So, yeah, so she agreed, and she said, let's try cholestramine.
Cholestyramine, yeah.
Pardon? Yeah. Mm-hmm. And she said, it's a lot of trouble because you got to mix the powdered drink and do it twice a day and all that. And I said, well, if I can have my life back, I'm fine with that.
I just want to comment. The drug reps come in and they tell you, they make these declarative statements like, your patients are 50% non-compliant with a twice-a-day drug, but if you give them this once-a-day super drug, they'll be 100, they're 90% compliant. And it's like, yeah, where'd you get that data? And it's kind of self-serving, isn't it, since you were the people with the twice-a-day drug 6 months ago, and now you got the once-a-day drug, and it's oh so much better? And
well, people like to swallow little tiny pills and get on with their lives.
People also like to have free drugs, and I'll tell you something. When people figure out that it's $10 to take the pill twice a day and $70 to take it once a day, they don't even stop to take a breath before they make that call.
Well, my issue is certainly, or my question is certainly not about...
I know, but I just had to,
I understand.
That in. Okay, so what is your question?
Well, my question is really, I'm only in about the third week of this or fourth week of this, and she said, let's give it 4 to 6 weeks before we do another lipid panel. Mm-hmm. There were dramatic positive results with the... simvastatin and prevastatin in spite of the debilitating fatigue.
So a couple of questions for you.
Yeah.
First of all, do you know what your C-reactive protein is?
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Then your doctor has missed something very important. So
well,
go back and ask for an HSCRP.
H?
Lowercase H, lowercase S, capital CRP. That's a really important test for women with high cholesterol.
Okay.
Because simvastatin and pravastatin do lower cholesterol. There's a very large group of cardiologists, possibly now the majority of cardiologists, who would say that that's not why it prevents heart attacks, second heart attacks, because we know it prevents second heart attacks. There's debate about whether it prevents first heart attacks, by the way. Mm-hmm. But second heart attacks, yeah, we got that. It does. It prevents them quite possibly because it's anti-inflammatory, not because it's lowering cholesterol. So if you have low inflammation to start with, compared to high inflammation, the amount of benefit you get from a statin is quite different. So that's point number one. The numbers look great on paper, but is there a survival benefit? Well, the devil's in the details on that one.
Mm-hmm.
Second point, when you get fatigue with a statin, using CoQ10 at 200 milligrams a day.
Using what?
It's an enzyme called coenzyme Q10.
Okay.
And I'm faulting your doctor for not having tried you on that before she gave you the second statin, because that's common knowledge and it should be tried. So you might have been able to use the statin with the CoQ10 successfully. And,
And eliminate the fatigue?
And eliminate the fatigue, exactly.
Oh. And that's another oral medication?
It's a vitamin pill.
Oh, it's a vitamin?
It's a vitamin pill. It's a particular vitamin
that
when you take a statin, your body stops making this vitamin. And depending on how, whether it slows down a lot or a little on making this vitamin, you get progressive problems with oxidative stress in the mitochondria, which are your energy factories in your cells. The mitochondria are the things that, like a transducer that turns electrical energy into physical motion on your air conditioner, the mitochondria turn food, calories, into ATP, which is the thing that moves all of your cells. It moves your muscles. It moves your enzymatic processes. It's the prime energy source of the body. Mm-hmm. So without enough ATP, your muscles get weak. And if you aren't generating enough because you don't have enough coenzyme Q10, it kind of cleans the mitochondria out, gets rid of the waste products. So if you don't have that, the mitochondria don't work well, you don't make enough energy, your muscles get sluggish. So supplying it externally is a really good idea. And I won't go into why, in their infinite wisdom, the drug companies never did this, but one of the very first statins that was brought to the market actually had CoQ10 in it, because we've known this biochemically for 20 years. But the drug companies were afraid it would affect sales, because if you tell people that you're not just targeting cholesterol, but you're also targeting a fundamental biological process in the mitochondria, that might scare them.
Mm-hmm.
So they might not want to take their pills.
Right.
So,
right.
I mean, it was a marketing decision. Nuts.
Yeah,
absolutely.
We don't know the, we don't want to know.
Right.
The,
we don't want to imply that there's something bad about our drug. Anyway,
right.
Ancient history.
That
the
is,
drug that you're taking, the cholestyramine.
Yeah, my question is,
what does it do? How does it work?
I'm getting a lot more information than I imagined, and it's beautiful.
But I'm doing this also for the listeners.
I understand that, totally, because there's a ton of us out here.
There are. But your question is about this cholestyramine and how it works, right?
I want to know if I'm, how does it work differently than a statin? And see, my HDL has already been wonderful. It's been in the low 70s all along. The ratio is, but the LDL came way down.
Which actually may have, if your cholesterol, total cholesterol to HDL is under 3.5, the chances that you'll actually benefit from tweaking the LDL are very low.
Really?
Yeah. But it makes you look good on paper. It makes your doctor look good. It eliminates the annoying letters from the insurance company informing you that your patient has an LDL that's in treatment category and you're not treating them. So, you know, there's all kinds of reasons. Plus, she can't get sued when and if you have a heart attack if she's done this. And I'm not saying that that's the motivation.
Yeah.
Because I'm sure that your doctor's sincere in her choices. But there's a whole lot of other stuff driving these decisions that's not science-based.
I understand.
Yeah,
no.
So the cholesterol, let me just briefly tell you how that works.
Sure.
The cholestyramine takes cholesterol out of your body and you poop it out. Essentially, it grabs it. It's called a bile acid sequestrant, which means that when you put bile in from your digesting of food, bile is largely cholesterol. It's got a lot of cholesterol in it. And under normal circumstances, a lot of that bile gets recycled. It's broken down in the large intestine and reabsorbed and goes back to the liver and is recycled. If you grab it and take it out, it's like bloodletting, cholesterol letting, essentially.
Right.
You're just sucking it out of the system. And the liver has to make more cholesterol. That tends to take cholesterol levels down because you just can't keep up with the loss.
Right.
So that it's got a setting. It's taking it out so the setting drops lower.
Sure.
There's not a lot of good data showing that cholestyramine reduces the frequency of heart attacks.
Oh, great.
It makes the cholesterol numbers look good.
Right.
There's not a lot of data that shows that it reduces the frequency of heart attacks. We had a drug called Zetia, which also lowered cholesterol by preventing this recirculation of bile. It blocked an enzyme that broke down the bile complex, and that was shown not to make a difference in heart attack rates. So it's kind of like maybe lowering the cholesterol just by itself isn't what we're after, which is why more and more cardiologists are saying, I think it's the inflammation, and I think it's the anti-inflammatory effect of the statins that cause them to have more benefit than the Zetia or the cholestyramine when we do these studies and try to show a benefit in not just cholesterol numbers, but actual event rates.
Mm.
And that's a real issue right now in cardiology. It doesn't stop the marketers and the health plans from
right.
creating these absurd criteria. And then
it's all about all around lowering the HDL
and then
LDL.
LDL and then hounding and pestering the doctors. But honest to God, if you go look in the data for women
mm-hmm.
and you look for evidence that a woman who has, let's say, a high HDL and a high LDL
mm-hmm.
has any benefit whatsoever from the statins, you will not find that data. There is mm-hmm. no study that supports that contention, none whatsoever.
And so that would also encompass the cholestramine.
Yes, it would.
Yeah, even though it works differently. Yeah, so yeah. It's all the same, all shooting for the same good numbers.
What we know is that we can make ourselves feel a lot better by measuring those cholesterol numbers and fixing them. We know that. We know it makes us feel better. We know it makes the patient.
For you.
Well, it's making us feel better, so
yeah.
It's improving the doctor and the patient's quality of life.
So what do I do?
Good question.
I have my energy back.
I'll tell you what. Let's do this. When you get those tests next time.
The lipid panel?
Yeah, when you get the lipid panel,
yeah.
You can call back and you can tell me your numbers, or you can email me
uh-huh.
and tell me your numbers
uh-huh.
and I'll give you a commentary on what I think. But realistically, get that hsCRP because that's the important number.
Is that going? That's probably going to cost me something because I'm requesting it. I'm not begrudging that.
Yeah. So what?
Yeah. Right.
Actually, it's completely justifiable if you have hyperlipidemia. That code will justify the cost as far as the insurance company is concerned.
So wait till I get the panel, and if I have the high, if the LDL hasn't.
No, get the hsCRP regardless. I never try to interpret lipids in a female without knowing what her inflammation is.
And is that a blood test?
Yes.
Okay.
Simple, and it's not that expensive.
So that wouldn't have been included in the workup I've had.
Depends on your doctor, her level
yeah.
of education.
I'll look on my
et cetera, et cetera.
Lab results and see if it's in there.
Right.
Okay, so what do I look for in the hsCRP?
You look for it to be above 1. If it's under 1, that's very low risk, which makes all of the LDL considerations shift dramatically in favor of doing nothing.
So above 1 is good.
No, above 1 is bad. The lower,
oh, okay.
The lower the better.
Lower the better. Wow. Okay, I've got a lot to think about.
Yes, you
while
do.
While I'm running, I have all my energy back.
Well, you go out there and run and exercise because that's as good as lowering your LDL by 30 points.
I've been doing this for 30 years.
Yes.
That's the control.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you for your time.
To be continued.
I'll call back. Thank you.
Bye-bye. And I wanted to point out one thing. I've noticed this trend, and it's a really bad trend. It's the doctors who are working for the large multi-specialty groups. They're starting to get reluctant to order tests. And I think it's because they're getting memos from their management telling them what's the appropriate workup for condition A, B, and C. And these memos are very conservative. They don't want to be doing vitamin D testing. They don't want to be doing emergent tests that might give you information because they don't have an economy of scale for running those tests and it costs them money, which affects the bottom line. There are some really awful perverse incentives right now in medical care, and they need to be addressed, and you need to be watching for them is, I guess, what I'm saying here. Let's go to Gail in Monterey.
I wanted to talk to you about CAT scans. My significant other person this week, when he went for his annual checkup, his doctor thought his abdomen was a little puffy, to quote him, and ordered a CAT scan, and he's about 6 feet tall, 56 years old, and quite thin. Of course, he's imagining the worst, and I'm sure there are other reasons for ordering a CAT scan besides cancer, and that's why I'm calling you.
Okay, just out of curiosity, your friend, how much alcohol does he drink?
Zero.
Okay.
Hasn't had a drink for 30 years.
And have you noticed him getting a little thicker around the midsection? Is that
something? Not at all,
okay.
No. And I kind of checked the area slightly above his hips, lower than the ribs,
mm-hmm.
In this area that's supposed to be examined, and I don't feel any lumps or anything.
Yeah, that's kind of sounding like the standard love handles area. So what could be happening is fat redistribution. I mean, the immediate common likely benign possibility is fat redistribution as a result of lowering testosterone levels and rising estrogen levels, something that happens to men gradually, in some men quite dramatically, but still somewhere between the age of 45 and 65. So that could be a factor, and that may be all it is. The doctor may have been concerned about fluid, which is sometimes called ascites. And typically you would see ascites in liver disease. So hepatitis, cirrhosis, and some people get cirrhosis silently, not because of drinking, but because of a genetic disease called alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency, and that'll show up in middle age. So that's one of the quote-unquote benign, not necessarily nice things, but not a cancer malignancy. And I don't know how old the doctor is, but one of the things I've kind of observed is that the ready availability of CT scans has led to their overuse. And
yes,
as a replace for doing a good physical exam and having confidence that one can, in fact, exclude significant ascites and can tell the difference between gas distension and fluid distension. As it happens, I've been reviewing my physical exam stuff because I'm teaching a class right now at the acupuncture college. And in doing that, I've been reminded of all of these tests that I learned in medical school back in the early 80s and have kind of forgotten about and eliminated from my physical exams because I just haven't been doing them. And I'm remembering them all. And I'm remembering also the fact that you can do these things with your hands and with your ears without resorting to irradiating the patient.
Right.
But I'm also very aware that in our current climate, there's no real penalty to the doctor for ordering a CT scan. There's a huge penalty for missing something.
Yes.
And that leads to a lot of unnecessary scans. And what
That's
we need
what
is
I was thinking.
What we need is a better system. I mean, if I were going to construct a better system for this scenario, what I would say is that you find something that's a physical anomaly, you have in that group or in the area a specialist who would examine the patient, who's basically a physical exam specialist and who isn't themselves just going to order a CT scan to prevent themselves from being sued. And if they felt that, yes, this was indicated, then you'd go off and get the expensive study. But the CT scans are comparatively cheap and easy, so we've made a decision as a culture that that's the way we're going to go, a medical culture, I mean. So now we're in the middle of it, and we're saying, well, how do we contain costs? And, you know, how do I, as a doctor, justify not getting a CT scan if I find anything that raises my suspicions?
Right. And,
you know,
that was kind of my feeling all along.
So it could be
good to hear you say that.
Yeah, I don't know. And it could be defensive medicine. There could be something that is really distinctly alarming. I'm not trying to second guess the doctor because I really am not there in the room with the doctor and the patient, and neither were you. And men tend to be minimizers. He may or may not be giving you the full story. I'm sorry. I mean, with all due respect to your relationship, men definitely soft pedal things when they talk about their health. And he's right at the age of denial.
Well, the word was puffy.
Puffy. Know. So he could be gaining weight, he could be fluid retaining, or he could just have a case of abdominal gas. And probably what I would do if the patient were self-pay, I would absolutely bring them back in a week and repeat their abdominal exam and, you know, charge them another office visit. That's,
well, it's going to cost them $600 for his portion of the CAT scan.
Well,
so
in
that's
that case, maybe it makes sense to just eat a diet that's unlikely to cause flatulence and drink plenty of water and make sure that you are pooping regularly and then go back and see the doctor a week later and see if it's still there before you get the CAT
Wonderful
scan.
Wonderful idea. I love it.
Okay.
I knew you'd have some good input. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Okay.
Okay. Bye-bye. I have a note from my producer to be sure to talk about this issue, and I do think that this is our moment. This is really bizarre. Okay, we've got the FDA, we've got the Food and Drug, we've got the EPA, and now moving into healthcare, we have the GAO, which is the Government Accountability Office. I mean, these are the people who look at what something's going to cost. I just wonder why they're even bothering to go after companies like 23andMe and Navigenics as another company that has been attacked by this latest reports. And essentially, I'm quoting the guy who testified before the U.S. House of Representatives, Gregory Cutts, and here's the quote coming from ABC News, assuming these genetic tests are credible, one would expect that identical DNA would receive identical predictions. I'm sorry, anybody who's got a degree in biology or medicine or physiology is just laughing their head off. One who might be an accountant would expect that identical DNA would give you identical predictions. But one who is a biologist would probably say that no, in fact, you can't expect that identical DNA is going to give you identical predictions. And that's simply because we don't know enough yet, and the predictive value of genetic testing has not been demonstrated. I've looked at some of these tests, and generally, they're very carefully worded. The results I've seen have mainly been a company called Genova. But let's talk about genetics for a moment and what this genetic testing is all about. There are these things called single nucleotide polymorphisms, which are a single base pair substitution in the DNA that doesn't damage whatever the gene product, usually an enzyme, is enough to make the person not survive gestation, but it causes it to be perhaps a little bit more or a little bit less efficient. Now, if you want to know more about this, go to the archives at Ask Dr. Dawn and look up the Jeffrey Bland interview on detoxification, because we talk about this at great length and it's very clear to get a sense for the issues. How well or poorly the liver enzymes work to detoxify drugs and to detoxify simple things you encounter in the environment, such as the nitrosamines that are created when you eat barbecue. Those nitrosamines, and also nitrates like lunch meat, which has nitrates in them to preserve color, these compounds are potentially carcinogenic, and your body breaks them down either well or poorly. So if I had a person who had a bad enzyme for breaking down barbecue, I'd want to encourage them not to eat barbecue forever, for the rest of their life, because they have a poor ability to take away the toxins. If someone had good DNA in that respect, then I wouldn't think that they were at increased risk for colon cancer from eating barbecue, and I wouldn't give them that advice. Would I wait? Would I actually try to do a study on barbecue and colon cancer? What, that take 2 decades in order to prove something? No, I would just look at what we know about the physiology, and I would steer people in the direction that is going to be a safer path for them. The Bland interview date, by the way, is April 22nd, 2006, and everything in that interview is still very current and very accurate. So we know that cancers are 30% genetic and 70% environmental, at least. But we also know that in that 70% of environmental, sometimes our genetic propensities will have an influence on how strongly or weakly we respond to environmental triggers. And if we can tease out that information and give people guidance, I consider that an extremely valuable service. But I don't expect it to meet the kinds of criteria that the GAO is looking for. It's not that cut and dried, guys. It's not numbers on a spreadsheet. And we're never going to get outcome data here that directly supports dietary advice. There's just too many variables. What we're doing with these tests is we're extrapolating from the epidemiology and from tests in lab animals and creating lab rats that are missing a gene and then seeing what happens to them, or cloning in one of these weak genes and seeing what happens to those rats. So we have enough data to say that it is reasonable to give dietary advice, to give lifestyle advice, and that certain individuals are going to benefit more from this advice than others, and those are the ones who should be doing it. Dietary advice is not a drug, and it is not something that needs to be held to the standards of drugs. The reason the GAO is going after Navigenics, 23andMe, and these other companies is because they're worried about what happens when we do have national health care. They don't want to see these things be a standard of care and then have to pay for them. Now, whether or not that's wrongheaded or not, I would leave to another discussion. But let's at least talk about what's motivating this. And also, who in the GAO has the scientific literacy to comment on this extremely complicated issue of genetic testings? And that doesn't even scratch the surface on the epigenetics and the environment gene interaction issues, all of which are horrendously complex and just beginning to be teased apart. The bottom line, in my view, these tests should remain private tests that people order and get for themselves. Having a doctor help them interpret them would be a really good idea. But taking these companies out of business because you don't like the concept, that's just wrong. Well, we've come to the end of another hour, and I hope you've enjoyed it as much as I have. I look forward to getting emails and commentary on this program and on previous programs, also your questions. Just go to askdrdawn.com and hit the contact us button. This is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.